Hello, testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 10, 10, 10, 12, 13, 14. Okay, that's good.
From the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Real World of Money with Andrew Goss. Once again, here's Patrick.
Yeah, once again, because I was here yesterday. I just sit here all night by the telephone. I mean, by the microphone. Just wait. Just wait. So, oh, it's 9 o'clock. I have my dinner up here. Do you do that, Andrew Goss? Do you just sit by your microphone all week and just wait to be on?
No. Well, yes, I guess I do.
Really?
Because my microphone is now on my desk. So, yes, I do.
Really? You have your microphone on your desk?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the engineer boys took one of the offices in the coin company and rigged up another studio, and I put my desk in it. It is.
And you put your desk in it. Okay. So you can actually get on the internet while you're on the air?
Not yet.
Not yet. Wow, you're working.
But
on
soon.
That.
Soon. Soon. Yeah, this was a former conference room, so I have a nice balcony to the outside where a little patio table out there.
Uh-huh.
I can sit out and enjoy some sunshine.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And then do you stay in your studio when you call heads of state and then see if somebody's listening too? It's like, boy. It's the Real World of Money with Andrew Goss. He's a currency historian. He's an all-around fun guy. Raconteur, doesn't play golf, but he's in Hilton Head, and he buys and sells gold coins for a living. Andrew, you're probably the only person in Hilton Head that doesn't play golf. I mean, you probably hold the record.
Or tennis, yeah, one or the other.
A lot of tennis courts there, huh? Yeah.
Oh, goodness, yeah. Uh-huh. Now, Vandermeer has a tennis center where they do instruction for kids.
Really?
They have tennis camps all summer long. It's really quite the sporting place.
Uh-huh. Yeah, a lot of tan legs and white shorts and that kind of thing. Well, it's kind of... You know.
Indeed, at the supermarket mostly.
Mm-hmm. You're only missing about 10 inches of global warming from up in New Jersey, so you're good.
So I'm told. Oh, goodness. So we're scheduled to go back at the end of this week, you know. So.
Oh, you really?
Really? I am, yeah.
So you just can't hold it off any longer?
I could, but it would be irresponsible of me to do that.
Really? And that's not the kind of guy you are, is it?
No, not an irresponsible guy.
Well, we talk about money on all different avenues. We get in a lot of geopolitics and local United States politics because how did you once say it, Andrew, that money and politics are inextricably tied together.
Well, that one's inexorable.
Inexorably. And it really is, isn't it? I mean, because it just is. I mean, it's just all about the money.
Money is politics, yeah. Money is war.
Oh.
Money is debt.
And debt is a blessing, but we know that.
And the electronic chain that we use today is much better than the old-fashioned chain where we used to have to chain folks up to make them work for us. Now government has figured out a way to let you pretend you're free while you're still working for the cause.
Oh, you're such an anarchist. You know,
thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Do you wake up and have your anarchist coffee this morning?
Yes. Well, you know Abraham Lincoln's definition of slavery, right? It was,
what?
You work, I'll eat.
Really?
Yeah.
You're working all eight.
As long as you can arrange it like that, it doesn't matter what you call it or how you facilitate it. You work, I'll eat. That's slavery.
Yeah. Well, there seems like there is a movement afoot around the world. Of course, we have the Trump thing going on here, but here's a little clip just to kick things off. What you hear is going on in the parliament in the UK. This was earlier today.
Do I feel like I'm attending a meeting of a religious sect here this morning? It's as if the global revolution of 2016, Brexit, Trump, the Italian rejection in the referendum has completely bypassed you. You can't face up to the fact that this bandwagon is going to roll across Europe in these elections in 2017. A lot of citizens now recognise this form of centralized government simply doesn't work, whether it's the miseries inflicted upon a country like Greece by the euro, the unemployment caused by bad regulation, or the feeling that none of us are as safe in our cities because of the disastrous common asylum policy. But at the heart of it is a fundamental point. Mr. Verhofstadt this morning said the people want more Europe. They don't. The people want less Europe. And we see this again and again when people have referendums and they reject aspects of EU membership. But something more fundamental is going on out there. Yes, you can say they're lying, and I've no doubt that many of you here, when you hear what I'm about to say, will probably despise your own voters. Because just last week, Chatham House, the reputable group, published a massive survey from 10 European member states, and only 20% of people want immigration from Muslim countries to continue. Just 20% want us to keep on allowing people in from Muslim countries, which means your voters have a harder line position on this than Donald Trump or myself or, frankly, any party sitting in this parliament. And that is where we're going. And I simply cannot believe that you're blind to the fact that even Mrs. Merkel
has now made a U-turn and
wants to send people
to Germany. And it's going all over. It's a nationalist movement afoot, Mr. Goss.
Yes. They call it populist movement. That way they don't have to call it what it is, a nationalist movement. What the gentleman said about the people want less Europe. They want more Britain, more Italy, more France. So they're not willing to surrender their national identity, and the backlash will be felt this year in Europe. In fact, I've heard many prominent people suggest that this could be the death of the euro and the European Union.
Uh-huh. What would that mean to... That would actually make the dollar stronger, wouldn't it? Oh. Which is what Mr. Trump and
Mr. Mnuchin don't
want, right?
Right. If the investors rush to the dollar for safety, remember the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry.
Right.
Scott the Trader made a mention of the dollar is terrible on his blog this week, in a little more colloquial terms.
Did he?
Did he? Yes.
Good for you.
Yes. So I would agree with that view. Even though the dollar is fundamentally weaker, in reality, if there's a collapse of the European Union, investors all through Europe and, in fact, around the world will rush to the dollar to sort of park their money on the sidelines. And that will be good for the buck.
Okay, so the odds are right now, they keep going up, that Janet Yellen is going to raise the federal funds rate. What's it at now? At about
a half,
or essentially it turns out to about 0.75 when you do all the fooey, suey, mooey and stuff. I don't know. About a half. But if GDP is really punky and there's no velocity, what's the motive behind doing that?
Well, there are two motives. One is always defend the dollar. So if it appears that there's any dollar weakness, Ms. Yellen would act, although she's lamented the fact, like others, that the dollar is so strong, in fact hurting our recovery. So it appears as though the same thing that I worry about is what the Federal Reserve will spend most of its time worrying about, inflation. So as much as folks want to expand and go during the Trump administration, it will be Janet Yellen's job to pull back on the reins and at least make it more expensive for them to take these risks.
Uh-huh. So,
I mean, she has fueled a dead asset bubble with these very low interest rates. Companies we've mentioned in the past have bought tremendous amounts of their own company stock on the equity side. And then on the debt side, you have people buying 30-year bonds because interest rates were going lower, not because they intended to hold them for 30 years. So this is malinvestment. It encourages the wrong sort of behavior because as soon as interest rates start to rise, then these same folks will rush to dump their bonds and dump their long-term debt assets.
When President Trump talked with Premier Abe Dhabi guy from Japan, right? He did this whole little great paragraph all about currency. I was trying to find it here. I had it somewhere, but you probably heard it, right? And he was pretty clear that we got to get to on a level playing field and currency and all this stuff. A lot of the one world currency people have taken this and saying, oh, you see, yeah, he's going to do another, other than the dollar, there's going to be a gold back dollar, and this is how they're going to balance out the different currencies, right? The only way you can really balance out the currencies is by tariffs. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you couldn't do it any other way unless you all use the same one, and then that's not going to work.
No, it's not.
I mean, you can't do that, can you?
Doesn't seem likely on the horizon. But if you agree to keep your currency within certain bands.
Bands.
Bands. Relative to your currency, my currency is going to stay, within this range. And your currency, obviously. And then each side does what they can to make their currencies match. That seems to work. The dollar accord.
I see. So
it's coordination, simply.
Yeah. So in other words, you have the yuan or you have the euro, but don't they all? The
or
euro
in this case,
floats,
the yen.
The euro.
They all float.
Floats.
They
float.
All float.
So it's
they
all by
float.
Supply and demand, correct?
Correct.
Isn't that the good way to do it?
That's exactly the way to do it. So if your dollar is too strong, or if your yen is too strong, and you start selling off some of the assets of the bank, in this case, Bank of Japan, why then you're putting less dollars into circulation. You're pulling money out of circulation. And the reverse is true. If you create money and buy assets, you're putting more money in circulation. One makes your currency go up, one makes your currency go down. And in this fashion, you can keep it within a specific range pre-agreed upon. And this is, of course, what the Paris Accord was all about years back, and many of these other meetings that you hear about, the G20 and Davos and things.
That's what they do.
That's what they do there. Okay. They get together and say, okay, we're going to do this to keep our currency within this band, and you're going to do that to keep yours within that band, and we'll all cooperate together so that ours doesn't rise too fast, yours doesn't fall too fast. Everyone shares their issues, and then they decide on a moving forward solution. Guys like Donald Trump and Brexit, just throw a big old monkey wrench into that situation.
Because?
Well, they're deviating from the plan. They want to try something different. And the people of Europe want to try something different. They've tried this euro experiment since 1999, and it just hasn't worked the way they want it to. So as a result, they're deviating from the plan that the politicians have set forth for them. It reminds me of that adage, find out where my people are going so I can get up there and lead them. The leaders have
like
fallen
it.
Quite,
find out where my
quite
people
behind
are
the
going.
Population.
That's hilarious. Find out where my people are going so I can lead them? Where'd you hear that?
Oh, that's an oldie, but a goodie.
Really?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I heard that in the... I think this was outside the Oval Office this morning.
Of course, Your Majesty.
I mean, it was.
I've come on the most urgent of business.
Yep.
It is said that the people are revolting.
You said it. They stink on ice.
I think it was Kellyanne Conway who said that on CNN this morning. My goodness. So there's people out there this morning and pretty reliable sources. And even, what's his face, who's that classic neocon?
Billy Crystal? William Crystal.
William Crystal.
Yeah, Bill Crystal
right.
with a K.
He
right.
said, he put a tweet out saying something to the effect, check this out, that, well, I'd rather have the deep state controlling things than Donald Trump.
That's right.
All about this this Flynn. And, there's a lot more to this Michael Flynn story than the Trump administration is saying. Something is stinky here.
And I think they were hoodwinked by Flynn.
Uh-huh.
And,
do you?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. So tell folks the quick story. This is his national security advisor. He had some conversations with...
During the campaign
with the ambassador or the... Uh, yeah, the, uh, the, the ambassador dude from Russia, right?
Yeah.
And he said that he didn't tell the FBI or Pence that he did talk about sanctions.
No. The sanctions. He allegedly, and again, one of the things that was revealed through all this is, of course, that the federal government, shock, records every international
conversation. They just do, don't they?
Well, so there's your proof. So remember when I said that the Army is run by sergeants and not generals?
All right.
So we've appointed a bunch of new generals, no question.
Like the whole cabinet.
Well,
and
Flynn
all these
would
guys.
Be one,
Flynn
all the cabinet guys, all the Trump people.
Right.
But we left all of the sergeants in place.
The guys who record the calls.
That's him. Yeah. And their loyalty lies not with the Trump administration, but with the former administration who gave them their wonderful positions. And so, and not just, let's say, the former administrations.
Or the deep state as well, right?
Yes, yeah. Who have been globalists for the last 30 years. So, you know, you'd have to go back 30 years to find someone who's a nationalist and is somehow in a position of public service at the rate of sergeant or higher.
Of course, so let me interrupt a second, Andrew. Mm-hmm. So these global dudes and dudettes, they've been in there for a long time. This is not anything new.
They're not appointees.
The William
Crystals
of the worlds and neocons. And,
well, but even, they even know they exist.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
And they are within government, and they have views that tend towards the global.
Uh-huh. That's all right. A little siren. That gives a little.
Siren gives a little. The fire station, man.
Siren gives a little color to it. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
That's the least of our worries. Okay.
Yes. Okay. So the globalists have made their way into government over the last couple, three decades.
Uh-huh.
And they've embedded themselves quite like a tick on a hound dog.
Mm-hmm.
And so when this all came out, that Mr. Flynn told the vice president, well, yeah, I did have a conversation because that's how it started. Oh, you talked to the Russian ambassador. No, I didn't. Well, yes, you did. Here's the call log. Oh, yes, I guess I did. Did the idea of removing sanctions come up in the conversation? No, it didn't. So then Mr. Pence in January went on the air on the Sunday talk shows and said, no, he didn't talk about that. And then they released the transcripts of the conversation.
Oh, and he did talk about it.
And he did talk about it. So then he had to go back to the vice president and apologize and threw himself on his sword because I think within the administration they realized that, you know, right out of the box, he's not on the up and up. And the fear is that you could be compromised, and this is something that the Russians are famous for, compromising our assets. So the fear was that Mr. Flynn was compromised, could be blackmailed, could be extorted, and so he had to go.
Uh-huh. So the story is out in a couple places this morning saying that this was the deep state's first hit on Donald Trump was to get rid of Flynn.
Do
you think that's possible? I guess
that is
possible. Anything's possible.
Yeah, that is possible. We'll see who replaces him. That would be the story.
So Donald Trump is just going to – this whole administration is going to have
– fighting tooth and nail.
Fighting tooth and nail – for 4 years, if he lasts that long.
Yeah, or maybe eight. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think he can last? There's already, of course, the Dems are out there talking about, we got to impeach Donald Trump.
Right.
You know, I mean.
Of course. And just as there were Republicans who spent the bulk of their first 2 years figuring out how to impeach President Obama.
Oh, see, well, we didn't hear it much, did we? I didn't hear. Well, maybe we weren't paying attention to President Obama because there wasn't anything going on.
Well,
pretty
you know,
much. I mean, did we pay much attention? I don't remember.
I know that as a Republican, when President Obama won the election, because I felt so blandly about his opposition.
Blandly.
Yeah, that's how would you describe
it? It's a blandy.
It's
a blandy.
He just had no people manner. He just did not impress me at all. So when President Obama, a very charismatic guy, became the president, my initial thought was exactly the opposite of the current crowd. Well, let's give the man a chance.
Uh-huh.
Let's see what he can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I waited a dignified period before I started picking apart his agenda. And I may do the same thing with Mr. Trump if he deviates too far from what he suggested during the campaign. For example, the 15% corporate tax rate, it looks like it's turning into a 25%
corporate
tax rate.
Well, what happened to that? Come on.
That was going to be,
that's a real plank.
That is a centerpiece.
It is a plank.
And if you don't have it, you know, of course, there are those folks that love to spend government money. And they're saying, oh, no, no, we need the revenue. Now, as I've pointed out before, corporate tax revenue for the U.S. Treasury is only 11% of gross revenue. So, I mean, in reality, cutting it in half may decrease the amount of revenue by about $600 billion. However, it will certainly encourage corporations to relocate here.
Oh, yeah.
A 25% tax rate? I don't think it'll do the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's not enough to force them or encourage them to come back to the United States.
So if Mr. Trump would get in a 15 or 20, let's just say 20 just to split hairs here, right? Half. And maybe gets in a 20% corp, which is now 30, correct?
35.
Oh, 35. Okay. He gets a 20, then would it be a good idea for our listeners in this country even to then do the whole corporate LLC thing? That would it make sense for them to do it if they have a business rather than being a sole proprietor?
You know that it will, because their tax rate will never be higher than that corporate rate. So as much of it as they can put onto the corporation, as much of their expense as they can put onto the corporation for deductibility purposes.
Man, that'd be great.
Yeah. And then of course, whatever is taxable is taxable at the lower rate. It would only be beneficial for an S-Corp or an LLC, because unfortunately with the C-Corp, the corporation pays the tax on the money, and then when it's handed over to the owner, he pays tax on it again.
And how does it work with an LLC?
Well, it's flow-through, pass-through, and the same with the subchapter S. You know, the whatever profits generate flow through to the individual whose subchapter S corporation it is. So it's not going to be helpful for those folks either. The real target here are the big corporations that employ a lot of people, because the benefit to the Treasury is not the 15% tax that the corporation pays. It's the hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs that payroll tax is paid upon. That's where the real money is.
But if you're one of our listeners who has their, say they're a sole proprietor, even if they're doing something like, maybe they're cleaning homes or selling donuts in a donut thing on the side of the road like they do in Austin. All these food, what do they call them? Food thing, whatever.
Food trucks.
Food trucks, right? I mean, everything that you do, because most little entrepreneurs, they're kind of so focused on their business, virtually everything they do surrounds that business.
Correct.
Right.
I mean, so all I remember of that, when I was nearly everything would be deductible.
Yeah, you could. So you drive your car, you have your gas, you do all kinds of your insurance. And
Your phone, your insurance, car,
everything, rent, right? And that's legal, right? That's all legal.
Of course.
It's all going for the company.
That's right.
So who are the forces behind not allowing this 15% deal to go through but make it 25? But even 25 would be better than 35.
Well, because it disrupts the entire globalist agenda. Yes, it would be 25 would be better than 35.
Those global dudettes again, huh?
Yeah, they don't. You know, then what's going to happen? Companies will start moving back to the United States, and how's Korea going to pay its bonds, and how's Indonesia going to pay its bonds or pay its shareholders? It's a worldwide system that has deprived the U.S. Treasury of a tax revenue and diverted it to other countries, which are more easily manipulated. You know, they don't have that pesky constitution in Korea. They have a different form of law. So it's easier for these multinationals and, in fact, globalist corporations to operate from a foreign base. So anything that causes everyone to rush back to the United States is viewed as anti-globalist.
And so we use this term globalist. You have for a while now. Can you, if you're on a game show, Could you give us maybe the top 5 or 10 globalists just off the top of your head? Corporations? Would that include things like, I guess, Monsanto, right? Archer Daniel ADMs, Boeing, that kind of stuff.
Oh, yes.
Boeing.
Yes. And don't forget the banks.
All the banks, right?
Citigroup and certainly Goldman Sachs and the Morgans of the world.
They're all over the world, right?
Oh, yes. And these trade agreements have allowed them to set up branch offices in these foreign countries that are still headquartered in the U.S. and allows them to poach the domestic market. Underwritings, bringing corporations public, buying up any smaller corporations that might have promise in the future. You know, that's all part of their agenda.
So that would be Microsoft, Apple, of course.
Oh, yes.
You know, all those kind of guys.
Yeah, the Sony, tech giants, Intel.
Intel, all those, yeah.
They really engineering and...
Yeah, they like this this model that's set up right now because it's very good for them tax-wise, right? Huge.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Amazon.
And again, taking over the world, Google. And these folks recognize that we're hampered because we are a nation of laws and not men. And, you know, our Constitution is real specific and our organized labor force and our international trading agreements and our domestic regulations all put a damper on their operating way. And so by moving their operations offshore, sort of on the plantation, while not hampering the revenue flow back and forth, that's the dream arrangement for them. You know, they're not subject to the jurisdiction of the IRS or the FDA or the FTC or the OSHA or any of the domestic regulatory agencies. And while they operate offshore, then they're free to sell their products here and reap the profits while undercutting domestic manufacturers who must follow those regulations. And a 25% corporate tax rate just isn't worth it. It isn't enough to say, okay, is it worth now going back and submitting to all this regulatory nonsense just for that small of a cut? 15 will.
Okay, so 15 will.
15 puts us near the lowest.
And the globalists then can control... They do control, I guess what you're saying, Congress.
Correct.
So that's how this works.
Yes, an incestuous relationship. So you listen to someone like John McCain, who clearly doesn't represent the American people. He's clearly a globalist stooge, in my opinion.
Can we quote you on that?
You can quote me on that.
Speaking of globalists, too, Warren Buffett.
Another one, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's not forget Soros, George.
George. And Warren Buffett, he kind of likes Apple. Did you see?
Yeah, he loaded up.
He bought, he now owns, let's see, 57.4 million shares of Apple. Mm-hmm. He's one of the top 10 stockholders. And he's got a $7.7 billion stake in Apple, which now is worth, you ready? $700 billion.
Why not?
They're working towards a trillion. Has there ever been a trillion-dollar valuation?
Market cap?
Yeah, market cap? Probably not.
No, I think this might be the first trillion-dollar company. But remember, we're talking, this is all the result of the adding of the zeros. You remember the adage, right? How long can this go on?
Yeah.
Until they run out of zeros.
Yeah.
And so the last generation's big company was a billion-dollar company. And the new generation's big company will be a trillion-dollar company. And guess what? When our grandkids are kicking around this
trillion,
microphone,
right?
Quadrillion.
Quadrillion, really.
Quadrillion is the next number. You know, once you've surpassed, like the global wealth of the Rothschild family is around $17 trillion. So, 17, a long way to go till you get to quadrillion, but nothing that a few good bouts of inflation won't take care of.
Andrew Goss and Patrick Timpone, it is the Real World of Money. Come on in and join us.
Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
Well, 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Currency historian Andrew Goss. Two books, Secret World of Money and Uncle Sam Cooks the Books. But go ahead and call if you have a question or a comment, or just kind of come on in. We have some interesting emails, and we're going to get to them. Stick around as long as it takes to cover all the tabs that I have open. Well, we can't do them all because, well, then we'd just be here till 4 o'clock. But got a lot of stuff to talk about. Let's see what I was going to go somewhere and just kind of lost it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, think about that for a minute while I address the balance sheet at the Fed.
Oh, you know, that's one of my tabs because the story said, how is Janet Yellen going to, what is it?
Unwind
her balance sheet. And I was going to ask you to talk to us like we're a golden retriever. Federal Reserve Janet Yellen set a relatively high hurdle for shrinking the central bank's balance sheet. That was on one of my tab in Bloomberg. Okay, what does this mean? What do we care? Who do we care?
Well, we should care.
Okay.
Because the Federal Reserve, in 2008, their balance sheet was $1 trillion. That means that they held in their vaults bonds, United States Treasury bonds, that were worth $1 trillion, for which they had created $1 trillion electronic or paper dollars and put them into circulation.
Oh, those guys. That's a great
thing. Yes. So during the course of the housing crisis, they decided to buy mortgage-backed securities, which they did. They nearly doubled their balance sheet in one fell swoop. And now it's up to $4.5 trillion.
Ooh.
Now, the thought that the Federal Reserve must always lean against the wind was first introduced by a gentleman named McChesney Martin, who was an early Fed chairman. And he said when everyone's buying, he should be selling. When everyone's selling, he should be buying. One of the things that's lending strength to the dollar right now, and is certainly going to put a little steam under it, is the idea that the Fed cannot unload its balance sheet. So when it does this maneuver where it creates money, puts it into circulation in exchange for illiquid assets, assets that couldn't be sold.
Like mortgage-backed securities, right?
Right.
The big short.
Treasury bonds, right.
Right.
So when they buy these assets and create the new money, the thought is that later on, they will sell the assets and withdraw the money from circulation.
Okay. Which would curb or keep inflation at bay.
Correct.
Okay.
And keep the dollar strong.
We're with you.
Yeah.
We're with you.
Well.
Now.
Janet Yellen yesterday said, there's no way we're going to do that right now because we need to increase interest rates so that we have a little room to maneuver before we start selling off our treasury bonds and our mortgage-backed securities. So what that means is there are no plans in 2017 to lighten the balance sheet, which has been hanging at $4.5 trillion since early 2014.
And okay, so
in fact, I suggest it's going to increase from here.
Okay.
It's not going to.
So you're talking about the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Janet Yellen doesn't keep these in her underwear drawer.
No.
Okay.
They are the government's fiscal agent.
Bank of New York. But Janet kind of has the ability to call up and say, buy $50 billion of mortgage-backed securities tomorrow, Charlie, will you? Okay. And he does,
that's
right?
The Federal Open Market Committee does that.
But they can tell the private owners, which are the usual suspect, Goldman Sachs, Citi, HSBC, J.P. Morgan Chase, all those guys who own the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, to go ahead and create the money on their Dell computer and buy them.
Buy more. Or sell.
Mm-hmm. That's part of the deal. That's part of the deal, being the central bank for the country. Okay.
Being the fiscal agent, yes.
But, okay, so I'm sitting there, and I'm the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and I've created dollars over the last 9 years to buy stuff that nobody else wanted because they were stinky, right?
Correct.
So I've got these pieces of paper in my vault. The money's out there sloshing around, but people aren't spending it. Why, if there's no real inflation, why do I care? I mean, just leave them there. I mean, why do I got to sell them? Just leave them there. Just leave them there. I mean, you didn't come up with any money to buy them. What do you care? Just buy more.
Yeah, it's like saying, okay, you know, I have all the stuff that I need this month.
Right.
And sure, I had to put it on my credit card and go into debt in order to buy it, but why do I care? I have everything I need. I'm not short of anything.
So the only reason
fiscal prudence would dictate that the Fed unwind its balance sheet.
Well, you know, when's the last time these people have been fiscally prudent, you know?
Exactly.
But the only reason that she'd have to sell or unwind would be to take money out of circulation.
Correct.
Right?
Right.
How does it take
And there's not enough
okay, so
from the
see.
Perspective of the debt markets. You remember worldwide dollar debt we talked about has doubled in the last 7 years. Yeah. Worldwide dollar debt.
Double.
And the Treasury of the United States has essentially trillion-dollar deficits as far as the eye can see.
Yeah.
I don't see anything changing that.
Just going.
So there's only about 30% of the money required to pay all of the debt currently due and payable. And as folks run around trying to get their hands on money, they're driving the value of money up, in the case of the dollar, and creating a circumstance where there's temporary dollar strength. There are no good fundamentals for
the
dollar.
Which is what we have out right now, right?
That's right. Yeah. If you look at if you look at the rest of the world, which has been buying U.S. Treasury bonds the whole time that we've been lowering interest rates, so you know, you buy a $10,000 bond when rates are 6%, and then when rates get to 3%, your $10,000 bond is worth $20,000. So the world's investors and the world's central banks have been selling, of late, U.S. Treasury bonds. So, you know, that chart that we publish on our site, because for decades, we've been hearing that China's going to sell its treasury bonds and Japan's going to sell its treasury bonds. They're going to get together with Russia. They're going to dump the treasury bonds and we're going to be in big trouble. Well, it's finally happening. Finally.
So they really are selling.
They've just started in December, and most recent figures in January shows,
a lot, huh?
A wave of selling. You know, all over the world, investors are taking their money out of the U.S. bond market. So it's like a $14 or $15 trillion market, and bigger deficits and more inflation and higher interest rates are kind of making them think twice about putting their money into long-term treasury debt.
So they know that Janet Yellen is going to be raising interest rates.
Rocking
and
hard.
They know that the dollar fundamentally has no real value except
no support.
No support except those F-16s, and Donald's going to buy more of those. So that's good. So then they're selling, and not buying.
Yeah.
And then when they sell, that drives the interest rates on the new guys up.
Yeah. In fact, you know, for all
it
these
makes
decades,
it worse, right?
It makes it much worse.
Makes it worse.
For all these decades, and I, you know, I'm going back to 02 in my current numbers, 2002, but I know that it went on before that. I addressed that issue many times before 2002. But through all that time, the net growth in change in how much people were adding, and they were adding between $200 and $700 billion a year to their pile. Probably the lowest year on record was 06, where they only did about $70 billion added to their pile. And then, you know, 07, 08, 09, 10, 11, 12, 13, add, $400, $600, $200 billion every single year they were adding. Well, 2016 was the very first year in 20 where the amount has actually gone down by $200 billion. So if you, again, look at that chart, I believe it's on andygoss.com. It's an aggregation of foreign debt holders. You will notice for the first time in a long, many, many, many moons, a decrease in the quantity dollar-denominated treasury debt held by foreigners. It's not a very nice prospect. Now, when it wasn't happening and people said it was, I said, of course, it wasn't an issue. But now that it is happening, it could become an issue very quickly.
Okay, so what are the issues, you know, to the bouncing ball moving forward, then what kind of things would affect our listeners, our dollar, inflation, that kind of stuff that we care about?
Well, that's what it would be, that loss of confidence. So when everyone is now a net seller, remember, it's a $15 trillion market. You ask Americans how much money they have in the bank, and we add it all up. In your checking account, in your savings account, that's that MZM figure that we talk about all the time. It's just north of $14 trillion. So if you took everyone's everything All the money in everyone's checking account, all the money in everyone's savings account, you still couldn't pay off the bond market. So when someone like Japan says, okay, I'm going to sell $200 billion worth of bonds, that has the same effect as the Federal Reserve selling $200 billion worth of bonds and drawing $200 billion out of circulation. Now, depending on what the Japanese do with the money, if they buy their own currency or if they buy another currency or if they engage in other debt instruments or if they just keep it domestic and buy, you know, United States properties and corporations, that money will come back into circulation only when the Japanese or whoever it is spends it. As long as they keep it in an account without spending it or without investing it, we won't know what's going to happen. And until they do, we won't know. So it is that uncertainty that will drive very many protective types of activities where folks will say, well, let's just step to the sidelines, as we've been advising World of Money listeners for a couple of years now. Make your maturities short. Do not buy a 30-year debt obligation. Buy a one-year debt obligation or a two-year debt obligation. And then you can sort of sit on the sidelines and wait and see without committing yourself to a long-term investment.
Uh-huh. One of the things that you've talked about on this whole globalist thing is the reason they like open borders is to keep wages stagnant. Is that right? That's kind of
correct.
They like that. And that's,
yes.
And if you look at the chart, it's pretty much flat over, what, 20, 30 years, wages,
right?
And then,
right.
And then, of course, real inflation
is much higher.
Is much
yes.
higher. So
it's outstripping
it might not look
wages.
Terrible on a thing. So, well, we haven't gone up much margin, but, you know, it's, you know, we're about the same we were 30 years ago. But when you look at what things cost, then you see that you're getting hammered, right?
Right.
Right.
Now, in 2006 and 7 and 8, when the Fed was making this increase in its balance sheet, there were many pundits, like myself, who believed that inflation was imminent right now, hyperinflation. Do you recall that argument?
Yes.
And they pointed to this increase in the money supply. But a basic understanding of economics will tell you that inflation is much more than just an increase in the money supply. There are three components that make up inflation, so get out your pen. Step one is, of course, the increase in the money supply. You need that to start the game, so to speak. But the second, monetary velocity, is much more difficult to put your finger on. It doesn't matter if the Fed is increasing the money supply double and triple. If people get the hold of the dollar and don't spend it and they park it, then that stalls monetary inflation. So imagine a $10 trillion money supply with a 200% velocity means that it's like $20 trillion flowing through the economy, $10 trillion flowing through twice. People turn it over on average two times a year. And that was the situation in 2007. Monetary velocity today is somewhere in the 1.2 range. So that same $10 trillion feels like only 12 in the economy. You with me so far?
I'm with you.
Okay, so the monetary velocity has to be kept in check, and that's done through uncertainty and through uncertainty and through uncertainty. The more folks are kept off balance, the less they're willing to spend their money. The more they desire to hoard it and to keep it in, the more confident they are, the more hope they have for the future, then the more readily they'll spend their money, and that will increase velocity. So it's possible to get a bout of inflation without a correspondent increase in monetary quantity. So that quantitative easing that we talk about.
Uh-huh.
So again, there's $10 trillion in circulation, and monetary velocity has been at 1.2. And now if you can increase monetary velocity to 2, that's like adding $8 trillion to your economy because it went from $12 trillion flowing through to now 20. The same is true for resource slack, the third component of inflation. So if there's a lot of new money created and a lot of people spending that money, then the factories, which are running at full capacity, and the workforce, which has very low unemployment, will suddenly start to demand higher prices. And so, again, that's the third component, resource slack. We increased the money supply 400% in 2007. And, again, great many of my colleagues interpreted that immediately as 400%. That means we're going to have massive inflation. But in reality, they put controls in place to encourage resource slack and to discourage spending through uncertainty. So monetary velocity fell and resource slack fell. So factories are currently running at less than three-quarters of capacity, and our unemployment rate, famously, worker participation plus the unemployed, is somewhere in the high double digits. So by controlling resource slack and controlling money with a zero, or that, monetary velocity, then we're free to increase the money supply without getting the attendant inflation. However, once you ramp up those other two numbers, the first number's already in place. Now, if you get people spending their money and you get factories and workers at full capacity, then you'll start to see inflation on the consumer side through higher wages and, of course, reflected in higher prices. So we've already done the first part. Now we're going to do the second and the third part. The elements that I thought were being purposely kept at this level so as to control the inflation. That's my thesis, and I'm sticking to it.
You're sticking to it. Well, well thought out, you know, and I'm glad you talked to us, too, like we're golden retrievers, because it helps when you do that so we can understand what you're talking about. It's a great, great concept, isn't it?
Helps me understand it, too. Just break it down into its simplest terms. And make sure you don't forget the details, because the devil is in the details.
Claudia wants to know, I don't understand your admiration of Mr. Trump when he's putting people like the boys.
Policies.
The boys in the Treasury Secretary. He was sworn in 2 days ago, Steve Mnuchin of Goldman Sachs. Yeah. Slacks. And there are a lot of people that say that to me when I say, it's going to be okay. Just, you know, I think Mr. Trump's going to do fine. And they say, well, look at the guys he's putting in there. I mean, so how do you respond to?
Okay, so I respond with that textbook standard that I use from the first SEC commission. So when the crooks ran rampant on Wall Street in the 1920s and led to the crash of 29, they held a series of hearings. They decided we needed a Securities and Exchange Commission, and they would promulgate rules that the securities markets must follow, and that would bring a degree of fairness to the system. And so FDR is looking around, who's he going to pick? He picks Joe Kennedy. His Treasury Secretary Morgenthau, being a very well-connected and well-known figure, says to him, are you out of your mind? You put Joe Kennedy as the head of the SEC? He's the biggest crook of all.
What's up with that?
And FDR said, well, sometimes to catch a crook, you need a crook. And I understand the logic. No one understands this game better than the former top players at Goldman Sachs. Now, every one of them that he's put in to these responsible positions, I would also note, are billionaires. I call it the Billionaire Brain Trust.
Yeah, even the Treasury Secretary is a billionaire.
He's a billionaire.
She's a billionaire. Yeah, DeVos, or what's her name?
DeVos is a billionaire.
Yeah.
I mean, there are billionaires everywhere. So,
they're everywhere.
And if you're going to bribe one of these people, you better bring a big checkbook, you know, because they already have plenty of money. So theoretically, their bout of government service is not to enrich themselves. Now, I'm going to keep an eye out for such double dealings, but what is the first thing Mnuchin suggests as he comes in?
I don't know. What?
The very thing that I've been harping on, the idea that we have financed 60% of the nation's debt in the short-term market. It puts us in a position of, well, it's like having your, you know, 60% of your house payment due in the next 4 or 5 years. It forces you to take more and more of your revenue and devote it to servicing your debt. And so Mr. Mnuchin pointed out, hey, why don't we have a longer-term bond? Our nation's going to last a lot longer than 30 years. Why don't we have a 50 or a 70-year bond?
Oh, these guys, you talk about using debt as a blessing. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
They get it,
And that's good for the nation, because to have, if we took our entire national debt and rolled the bulk of it into 70-year bonds. The servicing of that debt would be much smaller. Let's face it, I doubt very seriously we will pay the national debt in 70 years. However,
Who cares, did you hear that? Yeah, who cares?
You're not going to pay it in 70 years. Right. So why put it on a 30-year schedule or a 2-year schedule with amortization like that? If you took the national debt, you put it on a 70-year debt schedule, when interest rates are this low, we'll get the best deal as a nation that we would ever get. And so this is immediately an action of a Secretary of Treasury that's not thinking about his buddies over at, you know, Goldman.
Yeah.
He's thinking about what's best for the country. No Treasury Secretary has ever suggested longer-term bonds than the 30. And the past five have trimmed away the 30s in favor of ones and twos.
Which is good for the banks, right?
Which is great for the banks,
but not
great
for the
investors, not for we the people who are actually paying the bill.
But Andrew, who in their right mind would buy a 70-year United States Treasury
institutions
at 3%
institutions
or 2%? But I mean, what
again?
Don't they know that maybe we will see a 10% interest rate or 15% like in 1980, and then there's stuff they're buying is going to be worth spit? I don't understand. Well, why? Well, come
maybe
on.
We'll
if
see
I'm
a
smart enough
half.
To do that, why would they be dumb enough to buy one?
Got to put their money somewhere. Nothing any safer than a U.S. Treasury bond. And as far as the actuaries are concerned, all they need to do is match their maturities. That's all they need to do. So if you've got workers coming on now, to your organization, and they're going to be retiring, you know, they're in their early 20s, they're going to be retiring in 40 years, then why not match the level of your return to the level of their retirement? The same thing that you would do by tying the Social Security Trust Fund to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. You know, people are putting this money away, they're going to need it in 30 years. This consumer needs a mortgage, he's going to pay off over the next 30 years. Put the two together. So the longer-term maturities fit well with the institutions who need these fixed rates of return over the long haul. They know that they can count on it, and they know what it is, and they can figure it and move on.
Is that like
it a good investment? I don't think so.
Yeah, okay. Like MoveOn.org? No, it's different. MoveOn.org is different. Andrew Gospatrick, Tim Pone.
Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick at oneradionetwork.com.
All righty. It is a little bit after 10 o'clock. We're still in hour number one. We're going to have to do a station break here, but we'll just kind of keep moving on.org with Andrew Goss, currency historian. It is February 15th, 2017. Patrick Timpone, oneradionetwork.com. Andrew, I know that you're interested in these kind of things. I learned something yesterday that I thought was kind of curious. You probably know, but I was talking with a gentleman in Austin. He's got some very, very nice products that we're going to be promoting soon as we get all set up. Real colloidal gold, colloidal silver, colloidal copper. They're actually monatomic, which is about 3 million sizes smaller than nano. And he's got these, he was telling me about how he makes this colloidal gold. I mean, this is a real thing. The gold, the gold things that he sticks in there, you know what I mean, into the triple distilled water to make it.
9999999.
It cost him, I think, $20,000 for this thing. That's how much gold. Wow, yeah. So anyway, he was also telling me that he has some really, he's got a really good little program, very affordable for some kids with autistic behavior, that he's finding amazing things because this gold and silver and copper works on, the gold and the copper works on the brain. So maybe we'll hook you up there for your nephew, right, who's still got some?
No, it's my niece that has that. But there are, within the SDL family, too many autistic
kids.
Well,
we'll work on that, and I'll find out exact protocol. Maybe we'll turn you on, but this fellow's quite a mad scientist, a really interesting man. He did a lot of electronic stuff. He was very involved in when Texas Instruments bought all this Tesla stuff. You know, I didn't know that they have a lot of patents on all the Tesla stuff that they've always kept. Texas Instruments, right?
Oh yeah.
And this guy's really quite a engineer. But he was telling me We were talking about gold, and he told me that Apple uses $500 worth of gold in all of their computers.
Correct.
Wow, did you know that?
Yeah, and the silver is an even more dramatic use.
But gold is actually, he said it was a better, and that's why Apple uses the gold.
Okay, but it is better.
Better.
But the problem, remember, is that of all the gold that was ever mined in the history of man, most of it is still in circulation.
Right.
You with me?
Yeah.
But whereas with the silver, it's unrecoverable. So they use it,
and they use it,
and
they
throw it
in the dump or whatever, right?
Pretty much. Yeah.
Cell phones, computers, anything electronic.
Yep. It's not worth recovering the silver, where it might be worth recovering the gold.
I see.
So very little gold is lost through attrition, while tons of silver each year are lost through attrition. They're gone. It's not coming back unless you mine more.
But even if you had your old Apple, you couldn't open it up and dig out $500 worth of gold, could you? I guess you could.
Yeah. There's some scrappers in North Jersey that do exactly that. They, you know, take apart the computers and get all the gold contacts out and then refine the gold and so forth. So, yes,
I know you're electronic geeky guy. Do you think that extra gold I don't know if the other companies even use gold, that Apple does is one of the reasons why they perform so well? Or why would they spend $500? I guess it must do
something. Because the conductivity and the corrosion principles of gold, you know, very interesting about it that you could bury it in the ground, you could put it underwater. It doesn't corrode the way other lesser metals do. And so when you use it in something like a contact inside a computer that might be subject to a less than dry environment, and it's drawing the air in to cool the computer through the fans, the corrosion that takes place couldn't cause it to stop functioning.
I see.
And so by using gold, they eliminate that danger. Sure, it costs more, but as you said, you know, you're not going to have your Apple go down just because you live in a humid environment.
Well, I didn't say that, but that's what they do hold
that's
up better.
It is.
They
yeah.
do hold
that's
up better.
That's right. That's why.
I'll be darned. Yeah, it's funny, not funny, but interesting. My internet fellow said that's when they have their most problems, you know, because we have all these different radios bringing in ATT from Austin to get the bandwidth we need here in the country. That's when they have their most problems with high humidity and fog.
Yeah,
with the radios. Yeah. So that's what's going on, right? The moisture gets in there.
Corrodes the contacts and doesn't allow the transmission of electrical motive force.
I see. So how do the cars, like all the different GMs or the Priuses and all these guys, how do they get around that? Why don't their stuff corrode?
It does. And, you know, inevitably anyone who's changed a battery knows what we're talking
about. Okay, so that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, that corrosion that builds up there and you know, it's white and crusty, and it stops making contact. And when something as major as a battery with great big terminals, and you can see it, you know, you can fix it. But when it's something super tiny, like a little bitty connector on the inside of a computer, and it corrodes, man, it's just a nightmare. Mm-hmm. So that is something that gold provides that the other elements do not.
So then maybe somebody has a lot
one
of
the
equipment.
Things that,
oh, go ahead.
Yeah, one of the things that makes it money.
Yeah. So maybe somebody with a lot of equipment, they might do a dehumidifier if they had it in a little room?
Oh, yes. Yeah, you should. If you have a server closet, as we do here.
Yeah, I got one, too. I should do that.
Yeah, you should take steps. So we just got one of those portable dehumidifiers and leave it plugged in and, you know, drain it out. So it's just that simple.
And here in Texas, we don't get a tremendous amount. I suspect you get more humidity up in the East Coast.
In South Carolina.
Next to the ocean.
Man.
Wow.
Thick. You could cut it with a knife.
Cut it with a knife. Speaking of gold, Germany says, you know that gold that we want?
that you have and we want.
They just pulled out 300 metric tons. Well, they got 300 tons.
Yeah, they keep getting it. Uh-huh. And as the rest of the world starts to doubt that their gold is safe in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, they're asking for it as well. And I suppose that's okay as long as they actually have the gold. But you'll see, you'll find that the Federal Reserve is engaged in a lot of leasing. You know, it'd be like you go to a restaurant, and you check your coat, and then while you're eating lunch, they...
Do you want to rent Mr. Goss's coat?
They rent your coat out, yeah.
Not good. Yeah, so
Germany... Not good if you eat quick.
Yeah, Germany said that they, remember, they wanted a 330 tons, and then now this whole last year it's just been reported that they, as of December 31st, there were 1,296 tons of German gold in New York, so they pulled out about 300, and they said they're going to get it all by 2020. They want it all back. But they... You and other gold people have said that the Federal Reserve, and this is the, 80 feet under the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, right?
Correct,
The big vault,
right? The vault in bedrock, yes.
In bedrock?
It's actually in the bedrock of Manhattan, yes.
Whoa. Mm-hmm. You're not getting in there and stealing that stuff.
Oh, no, sir.
No way, Jose.
No.
And there's no idea how much is in there or who owns it or any of that. And
that's right.
The Federal Reserve doesn't put that on their book. Well, they don't have the book. They don't show their books. They're private.
Well, no, but if they show a gold holding,
like we had the other week, last week, right, or 2 weeks
correct.
Ago, we did the
it
whole
doesn't
thing.
Necessarily have to be in physical gold in their vault. So, you know, to them, let's say that they've got 300 tons of German gold, and someone says, "Gosh, you know, I really need 300 tons of gold." They say, here, you take this 300 tons of gold, give it back to us in a year, and then they buy an option. So when they lease you the gold, they lease it to you. You give it back. You're not buying it.
Can't you just buy it?
Yeah, you can. So the point is that their counterparty risk, you know, having gold in the vault eliminates your counterparty risk. Having someone owe you gold really puts you in that same position of counterparty risk that that you were in when you were just renting it. So the Fed could very well get caught in a short squeeze and find itself. Now, understand that it has the ability, unlike other entities who would be short gold, if the Fed decides, oh, goodness, well, we're way short and we don't know that we're going to get the least gold back in time. So we have to buy gold in order to give it back to Germany. So we're going to buy it at a rate of 30 tons a month, and we're going to create the money to do so. Right? They have that ability. So the shortage of gold, all it can do, it's not like they're not going to deliver, but having to buy to replace the gold that they've leased, that might cause prices to rise rather dramatically on the bullion side.
So why wouldn't somebody like Germany, Andrew Goss, just say, we just want it all. I mean, you know, just send it over. I mean, just what are they dinking around for?
Well, I think they realize the intricacies of what the Fed is doing, and they're trying to give them some room, some wiggle room.
Oh,
remember,
that's nice of them.
We cooperate, they cooperate. You know, the Central Bank of Germany, if you will, the Bundesbank, it was pretty much established by the Federal Reserve boys, same as the Bank of Japan post-World War II. So they have a long history of cooperation with each other. And, yeah, we want our gold back, but we're going to give you plenty of time to make sure you have it so as to not put a strain on the markets. Because imagine if the Fed was really short 1,000 tons of gold and Germany said, we want it next week, the Fed would have to rush out into the marketplace and buy 1,000 tons of gold, which would cause the price to skyrocket immediately.
And they don't want that.
No. So by giving them time to buy it on the open supply at a reasonable pace without revealing its existence, as you noted, they didn't tell us that they took 300 tons till after they took it.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, this would, of course, calm the markets enough that they could take 200 or 300 tons of gold over a year, and no one would notice, so to speak. But if they tried to do it all at once, oh goodness, that impact would be devastating.
Legendary investor Jimmy Rogers, who Andrew has met, has been on a panel with him, and he likes him, and he's got a lot of respect. He's got some things to say about gold and other stuff. We don't have audio, but I'm going to go over it right after this little quick, short station break. Some of the things that are going on out there, Andrew, in the gold coin world is just, and the bully, and it's just amazing. You hear on the radio some of the things these people say. I mean, they just make stuff up. I heard some commercials on KLBJ yesterday, this big gold company, I won't even mention their name, about what's happening and why you need to buy gold now. And boy, you talk about weird stuff. It's like, what are you guys talking about? It's like, they just make it up. They just make it up. Isn't there any rules?
No.
I guess there's not.
Unregulated market.
I guess there's not.
And, you know, it's anyone can have a theory and hypothesize and say, okay, this may happen.
Oh, you're allowed to do
happen.
That. Yeah,
yeah, you go ahead. Uh-huh. You know. But for me, anyone who tells you to sell everything you own and buy gold, that you should, you know, sell all your stocks and sell your real estate, sell everything and just put the money into gold, is not a very prudent planner. So I don't know that I would take that advice. And as bullish as I am on rare coins, you know, I always make sure that my customers are suited to the coins they buy and that their goals are equivalent to what the coins might provide. And the idea that the economy is going to collapse in a, you know, the impending event that's going to cause the dollar to collapse and that you should move all of your money into gold or silver by that date.
Right.
I don't know. That just seems to me like some phony sales pitch because I've been hearing them for so many years. You know, that's the reason that you should buy gold coins or gold or silver coins, because the economy is going to collapse and the world is coming to an end. It's absurd. More logical is that we have this same slow, static in the long term, and coins being a passive income generator. So it's worth $1,000 this year, and it's worth $1,100 next year, and then it's worth $1,250 the following year. And in no instance does it throw off a 1099 and suggest that you now have to pay tax on the gain. Until you sell it, there's no tax due. So it
now
is
that's a
great.
Cool, that's a cool thing, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, it is. Yeah.
That's a cool thing.
It's a passive income generator.
So that's the difference between passive. So there's no 1099.
Correct.
Each year, even though the coin in your underwear drawer may be worth more, you don't pay the taxes gained until you sell it, right?
That allows for the compounding of that return.
What do you mean compounding?
Well, let's say you have a $1,000 item and you make $150 on it and $50 away to taxes.
Okay.
So that $50 is gone. It doesn't have a chance to grow. But now that $1,000 item that passively grows to $1,150. Now the $1,150 grows instead of just $1,100. So it is, again, it allows for the beauty of compounding. And I always point to that engineer, John Pittman, who never ever viewed himself as ever selling a coin. And in fact, he never did. His entire collection was left to his heirs, who became multimillionaires on an engineer's salary because their father was prudent enough to spend his life accumulating a pile of rare coins and allowing them to grow over 20, 30, 40 years. I saw some of Mr. Pittman's purchases from 1949, and they weren't sold until 1996.
Wow.
And the growth was phenomenal, 1,000%, 2,000%. I mean, the types of numbers that really boggle the mind. But a more conservative investor, especially following Solomon Brothers' list, might expect a return of 15 or 20% compounded annually, which over the long haul, now granted, any given three-year period, you could be taking a multiple loss on coins. If you bought coins in 2011, gold, silver, I don't care, unless it was the rarest of the rare, if you were just buying regular run-of-the-mill coins in 2011, guaranteed they're worth less today. Guaranteed. Gold was $1,900. Silver was $45. Today, gold is $12 and change, and silver is $18. So it is much better for you to average your way in rather than to listen to some commercial that says sell everything you own and try to pick the bottom of the gold or silver market. It's just, it's very unlikely that you'll be able to do that. And so by averaging in, as my long-term customers know, I don't try to get you to put everything you're ever going to invest in coins in at one time. You know, you work small, work your way up, buy coins, average in. That way you take advantage of the lows, and you're not trying to buy when it might be high. So it is.
Well, and I think it's a real testament to where you've built your company, Andrew, with people that have been there forever. I mean, I know a friend of mine who got a job in Houston selling gold stuff, and he didn't have he didn't know anything. Zero. I mean zero. So he called me over and he asked me if I could help him to understand a little bit about how gold prices work and all that stuff. And I brought a whiteboard and I kind of gave him some heads up. And he had a little advantage over almost everybody else, you know, that he was his co-workers, because he actually understood a little bit about it, you know.
Correct.
And these are the kind of people, you know, we don't talk negatively or gossip about other companies, but these are the kind of people that are on the other end of the phone.
Well, if you're gearing your operation to this sort of sales.
Just to sell, right?
Just to sell. You don't need, and this is reflected in people that tell me, oh, I've invested in coins. Oh, great. What kind of coins do you have? I don't know.
I don't know. I'm in my underwear drawer. They're in there somewhere.
That's right. Well, how did you pick them? Well, the guy picked them. What did he know? I don't know. Because, I mean, it's like that we try to educate our clients. An older guy who's long since passed away, Cy Sims in New Jersey, had a motto, an educated consumer is our best customer. And that's the way we feel at SDL. If you understand how the markets work and you understand, you know, price issues and grading issues and market supply and demand, you're educated enough to know and recognize, just as we would, that something is a good or not so good deal. And we make it our business to make sure you understand why we think you should buy that Missouri half dollar or that Texas half dollar or that $1,810. Because once you understand as an investor or consumer, it makes you more comfortable. And over the long term, which is the way we look at it, we have clients for 30 years. You know, they keep and stay with us because we care about them and their coins. And that's a lot different from a company that just wants to sell you coins today. Your broker's here today, but he's gone tomorrow and a new guy is in his place. We don't play that. We try to have some degree of longevity and continuity, and that's what you can expect from SDL.
I promise you a little thing on Jimmy Rogers. I looked for the audio, couldn't find it, but I didn't take the time to do it. But just to give you some bullet points on his latest interview that's out there, he is accumulating gold bullion on the dips. No surprise there, right? No.
No, he's always been.
He's always been on the dips, by the dips, so he's buying bullion. And he's a big investor, and now he lives in Singapore, very well respected. He said, get prepared. He said, we're going to have the worst economic problems we've had in your lifetime or my lifetime.
Right. Yeah.
Now, this is Jim Rogers saying this.
He's in his 70s.
And, he's been around, right?
He's been around the bend.
So are you agreeing with him? I mean, is this Redux 2008, when we started the show?
Yes, because we didn't solve those problems then.
We didn't solve them.
Nothing. We simply papered over them. We didn't solve anything.
Nothing.
No. Well, and in fact, as I pointed out, worldwide dollar-denominated debt doubled since then.
Since 2008.
Right, and the problem then was we had too much debt and not enough money to pay.
Right.
So here we are, 7 years later, we've quadrupled the money supply and doubled the worldwide dollar-denominated debt. We didn't solve any
problems.
But
we should have the money to pay the debt if we quadrupled and doubled, right?
Well, in theory.
But
we don't. We didn't have enough then. Even though we quadrupled, we still don't have enough now. And as that four times as much money starts entering circulation due to monetary velocity and resource slack coming together to provide a perfect storm where you easily would see double-digit inflation, easily. And so I think Mr. Rogers is probably worried about a great many of the same things I am.
Yeah, let's see what else he says here. History showed trade wars lead to real wars, because he's warning that with Mr. Trump and his team are very, very keen on having a trade war with China and other people. So he's saying that they always lead to real wars. Ooh.
Yeah, don't feed the bears. It is true.
Gosh.
So we've been essentially handing out a free lunch to the world's economies. so they could come and get their free lunch, rebuild their nation, build their nation.
How long has this been going on?
Oh,
30 years?
Since NAFTA, yeah. 20, 30 years, easy. Yeah. Yeah. So now all of a sudden we say, hey, wait a minute, you're going to have to start paying for lunch.
Not good. They're not going to be happy.
The bear actually, you know, gets angry and starts tearing at your stuff. And, you know, if you're not going to give me that free lunch, I'm going to take it. You know, that's why we don't feed the bears. And here in South Carolina, we don't feed the alligators either. It's a crime to do so.
Yeah.
Because once they get complacent and find their source of free food cut off, then they get violent. And, yeah. and violence, yeah.
But you don't want to get in a war with China. I mean, what's up? That'd be crazy.
Yeah.
Or Russia. Well, we're in wars with Russia all the time, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, kind of, sort of.
We are in a condition of perpetual war.
Yeah,
and
you're going to cry.
It is the
right?
From the banker's perspective, they can create as much money as is needed to prosecute the war, and then the productive energy is dissipated, so the inflation isn't felt. So you know,
blow
you spend
right?
$100,000, make a bomb, drop the bomb on a house now. The house is gone and the bomb is gone.
No inflation.
There's no inflation. But the money, and now we're free to start the cycle all over again. So they love war. They love it.
Mm-hmm. He also says cashless society, cashless means less freedom.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I feel now, when I talk about a cashless society, I feel like I'm predicting the past.
Yeah.
As I've pointed out, greater than 96% of everything we call money is a mere electronic blip on a computer screen, much like Bitcoin, just an electronic representation of wealth. And when you have such an easily created unit, then the temptation is to do just that, to just create more rather than work within the existing supply. So as they create more, and of course the zeros get added onto things, that's how we suddenly get trillion-dollar companies and quadrillion-dollar economies and so forth. So just get used to the big numbers, and we're moving forward. They're not astronomical numbers anymore. They're economical numbers. Those are the big numbers. You know, distance to stars and things like that used to be the biggest numbers around. Now the biggest numbers around are economic numbers. And just get used to it, because that's the direction that the world is taking. It's much easier to create new money to pay off your debts than to allow a default that sort of crushes all the players. So it's easier, much easier to simply just create the money and pay the debt than it is to admit that you don't have the money to pay the debt.
Mr. Trump just got out of a meeting with a bunch of business leaders at the White House. And I got some tape here. Let's see if we can hear it. I haven't previewed this, so I don't know what trouble.
The retailers.
Yeah, and the retailers. Let's see what he says here. Let's see if we got something worth listening to.
There's some great retailers here today, and we're going to go around the room, and we'll all introduce ourselves. Some of you I've read about on the covers of business magazines, and it's great to have you here. Thank you very much. I'm pleased to host all of you at the White House. The CEOs, you're some of the great CEOs of our country and the biggest in the retail industry, which is very important to the country in supporting millions and millions of jobs. Really one of the great job producers. Probably, would you say, almost number one? Pretty close, right? It is number one. There's a lot of confidence in our economy right now. There's a great confidence level. You've been seeing that in the stock market. You've been seeing that in businesses. And you've been seeing that on every chart that's taken, is evidenced also by the jobs report that just came out for January, 227,000 jobs added. My administration remains very focused on the issues that will encourage economic growth. That's what we're all about. We have a lot of plants moving back into various states, including the state of Ohio, the state of Michigan, Pennsylvania. We have a lot of companies moving back in, coming back into the country, bringing the jobs with them. We're cutting regulations big league. We are really cutting them by massive amounts. The auto industry just left a week ago. They were here in the same room, and they're very happy with what we're doing, and everyone is. I think just about everyone. The financial industry, we're having a lot of the different industries in. And we're cutting regulations in just about every industry. In fact, I can't think of any that we're not. If I do, we have a major story, okay? Because I think just every industry we're cutting, some more than others. You have a very, very big regulatory problem, and we're going to take care of that. Because I want more jobs. I'm doing it because we want more jobs. As you know, the overregulation costs our economy an estimated $2 trillion a year, which is incredible. $2 trillion. And it costs your businesses a lot of money, tremendous amounts of money and time. I've taken executive action to create a permanent structure of regulatory reduction by creating one in one. So basically, for every one regulation.
Okay. The reason I wanted to hear it, I don't know how far in the tape to hear it, but here's a quote from what he said this morning. We're doing a massive tax plan, as there will be a much, much simpler tax code that will lower rates for everybody in every bracket, he added, other than H&R Block. People are going to love it. Well, yeah. So do you think he's going to be able to really get that through?
Well, and
you know,
this
the
is
massive, much, much simpler, less taxes.
Yes. Okay, so, and this will also speak to the previous writer who asked how I can support Donald Trump.
Right.
And I will say that I only support Donald Trump's policies, and these are examples of the policies that I support. And the moment that he changes and starts acting like every other politician, then that's the moment he'll lose my support. I'm not an undying Trump fan, especially if, again, he starts wavering on these principles. If he's not going to cut the corporate tax rate, if he's not going to give us simplicity in our personal taxes, if he's not going to reduce regulation on America's businesses, if he's not going to impose tariffs on imported goods, then he's going to lose me just that fast as he got me. So that's why I'm a Donald Trump supporter, not because I think he's some sort of great man. It is indeed his work ethic and his regulatory stance that makes me a fan. And if he changes either, he's going to lose me and I'm sure a bunch of the rest of the country as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like that he does stuff. Whether or not it's all right, he just does stuff. And he wakes up every day and does stuff.
Very
and,
productive, yes.
And, you know, mm-hmm.
He must be taking his sulfur, I would guess.
You think so? Yeah. I think so. Okay, let's do some emails here.
Okay.
Oh, well, let me see. I got a little sun on my computer screen. It's tough to see. Okay. John writes, what causes inflation? So I sell a thing, like a house or a car, for 10 times what I paid for it decades ago. It is still the same one house or same one car. If I
right.
replace it after I have sold it, I must pay more than I received. I must pay more than I received.
That's
How
right.
is it I have made a 90% profit on
gain,
that
right.
sale?
And you've had to pay a tax on that gain. So, as you pointed out, so that $14,000 house from 1967 is a $350,000 house today. And did you make $335,000? No, you didn't. But if it's an investment, you pay taxes on that $335 as though you earned it. So it is unfair to have a dollar that is so fluctuating that over time, you get this type of imaginary gain. The caller is, or writer is correct. If he now went to try to buy a comparable house, he'd have to pay that sort of money. It's
sure.
not like he can
yeah.
buy another one for $14,000. So
sure. yeah.
it's unfair to tax people on long-term capital gains without factoring in inflation. And then, of course, that's where they get that phony CPI number. So any type of a tax scheme that said, okay, you bought the house in 1967, and we've experienced 100% inflation since then, so you're allowed to deduct $30,000 or $28,000 from your gross, that still wouldn't account for the inflation that we've really seen over that period of time.
Sure.
So it is an unfair system of taxation. Taxing productivity instead of consumption is what put us in this place in the first place. So the combination of the Federal Reserve Act, which guaranteed the inflation of the currency unit, at the same time institute an income tax, it's just a guaranteed system of slavery. I don't know how else
just
to describe
work.
It.
So, but you've never been a fan of a Have you been a fan of a consumption, like a value-added tax to do it all, and you don't pay any money until you buy stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Is that okay?
Would
that be cool?
I would go for that if we eliminate the income tax.
Do you think they'd ever do
that? And replace it with a consumption tax.
Boy, I'd love that, too. Man.
Yeah. Because you decide what you consume or don't consume.
Sure.
And the very rich consume so much more.
Yeah, they buy airplanes and boats and stuff.
Boats and whatever. Right, all that stuff. Yeah, exactly. So they were going to pay more tax naturally. But the argument is that the person who's just barely making ends meet ends up paying tax on all their consumption and doesn't get an earned income credit, you know, and all of the wonderful tax treatment that's given on the income side. So it's my firm belief that by taxing income, that's direct capitation, taking it right off of what you make, right off of the top, it allows them to control inflation more succinctly. And I've often made the argument, and I'll make it again, that tax policy for revenue is obsolete. The idea of collecting an income tax in order to pay the bills is obsolete. Taxation, in fact, for revenue is obsolete. Government could simply create whatever money that it needs. So let's say, for example, we have a $14 trillion economy, and we say that our federal government is free to create $1.5 trillion a year and add it into circulation to pay for its operations. No income tax. And that would necessarily mean that the money supply would increase by 10% each year, and the inflation rate would probably correspond, but you would never pay another dollar of income tax. So financing government spending through taxation is an obsolete concept. I would point to the paper written in 1946 by the president of the New York Fed on his way out. Huh. His name was Beardsley Rummel, R-U-M-L. And he wrote that exact piece, taxation for revenue is obsolete. The idea that government should collect any of your money in order to pay its expenses is an outmoded concept. And unfortunately, it's geared towards an additional hidden tax that you never see until a lifetime has gone by.
And Andrew, you've even alerted us to a still-standing Supreme Court decision that actually said when you trade your labor for dollars, it's not income.
Right. You're referring to the Pollock decision, 1894.
Yeah, 1894. Of course, why doesn't that work today?
Why doesn't it work today?
I guess you could fight it if you wanted to go to court.
Because there's no one who's not in the forum. See, this is the point. When the Supreme Court issued that ruling in 1894, there was no income tax. There were no federal adhesion contracts. There was no Social Security. There was no zip code. There was no Federal Reserve System. And so there was no way that the District of Columbia could adhere itself to you or adhere you to them and force you into some sort of behavior. So it is only through the addition of these adhesion contracts, I mentioned a few, discharging your debt with Federal Reserve notes instead of paying them with lawful money. That's one. The zip code creates a federal jurisdiction over the entire United States. You use a zip code, you're in the forum. The income tax is, of course, another, you know, voluntary system, as they put it, that enables you to declare yourself to be within the forum. In 1894, there weren't many United States citizens. Now, I say that because anyone who was naturalized by the District of Columbia and conferred citizenship was not a citizen of Texas or a citizen of Virginia. They were a citizen of the United States, and so they were subject to their jurisdiction no matter where they went in the country. But a natural-born organic citizen from 1894 had no adhesion to the federal government at all. And they didn't have ATF and IRS agents, you know, swarming through their towns without the knowledge of their sheriff. That's about who they had to worry about: the sheriff, the state police, the governor, and the people that make the laws in their state. And they were the ones that forwarded the money to Washington to pay for their operations, not the individual citizens. So we've gone a long way away from what the Constitution intended as a means of financing our operations.
So it wasn't until we got unknowingly in these little adhesion contracts that that Supreme Court decision doesn't mean squat.
Yes, that's right.
But if
because,
you, but isn't
you know it, what? The Supreme Court has also ruled that you have a right to free speech, right? You have a right to speak your mind.
Right.
But if you're a baseball player and you're on the diamond and you're speaking badly to the umpire, he's free to throw you out of the game. Now, you're just expressing your constitutional right to free speech. How come he can throw you out of the game? Why can't you sue him for violating your constitutional rights? Well, because you surrendered them when you joined the ball club. And that's the same thing with these adhesion contracts. You've traded your organic rights for civil rights. And so the rights you have are the one that government decides to give you as a 14th Amendment citizen. You're not an organic citizen anymore. And you take any American, line them up, 10 in a line, and say, okay, one at a time, are you a U.S. citizen? That's your question. And you're going to go down the line, and all 10 of them, I bet, will say yes, I'm a U.S. citizen.
But
well,
really,
okay,
right?
Then you're subject. If they say well, they are.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Then you are. Yeah.
You're subject to the jurisdiction, then, of the federal district government. And I've had this argument with many lawyers, and I espouse the idea of state citizenship and states' rights, and by virtue of your state citizenship, you have all the rights of a federal citizen plus the rights given to you by the Constitution. And one particular lawyer said, you know, he went right to the heart of the matter. He said, we settled all that after the Civil War. So after the federal government smashed down its jurisdictional hammer on the United States, the hierarchy of sovereignty is viewed as we the citizens on the bottom, and then the state government one height above us, and then the federal government the supreme power of everything. That's not the hierarchy of sovereignty given to us by the Constitution. It is we the people at the top. We created the state governments. The state governments created the federal government, which is at the bottom. So it's been turned upside down, and we've all been convinced, yes.
Yeah. Cattywampus for sure. But
yeah,
isn't a contract not really a contract if you don't really understand all the terms?
Constructive fraud, yes it is. But
wait a minute,
in order
constructive fraud?
That's constructive fraud.
Well,
if you signed a two-page contract,
right,
and then the next day they come out with a third page, oh, this was part of it too. And now you say, wait a minute, I didn't agree to that third page. Well, too bad, your signature's on the contract. So what is your remedy at law? You can sue. That's what you would have to do. Fraud vitiates the most solemn contract. So if this type of fraud, in other words, if you've entered into an adhesion contract with the federal government that has terms that weren't revealed to you, then you can sue and allege that fraud was committed in the inducement in order to get you to sign the contract. They held out the third page. But that is your remedy. You must sue. You can't. If you don't, then you acquiesce, and that jurisdiction is assumed.
Has anybody ever
unless
done that
it's challenged
successfully?
Well, that's what gave us the Pollock decision. You know, that's
why
it got to the Supreme
Court.
Wait
a minute, I thought in the Pollock decision they didn't have any adhesions, so I lost you there.
Well, they didn't, but the idea that the federal government was reaching into the states to take jurisdiction over something that was challenged by someone. So, you know, depending on which level of government you challenge and which, you know, level of law you challenge.
Good luck with that, right?
Good luck, yeah. If it's a constitutional question, you'll have to go all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yep. You know, I was looking at that as well. I guess Gorsuch is, I guess he'll get confirmed, right? He'll probably get confirmed.
Yes.
And then there's a couple other ones that are, like, really old here. I was looking, let's see.
We have tons of judicial appointments that aren't being met because of the disagreement between the parties. So there are plenty of federal judgeships that are open right now.
Well, I'm talking about Supreme. Anthony Kennedy, he's 80 years old, right?
Ruth Bader is a little...
God bless Ruth Bader. She's 83.
Right.
Oh, well, Kennedy, wait a minute. Is Kennedy really 80? Yeah, he's 80 years old. So that could be a Trump appointee?
Yeah.
Ruth Bader
in fact,
could be a Trump appointee, right? She's 83.
Well, Ruth Bader, see, if Ms. Clinton would have won, Ruth Bader would have resigned immediately.
I see. Okay.
And allowed Hillary to appoint her successor.
Ah. Okay.
But now I believe she's going to just wait out Donald Trump.
That's right. She's going to just sit at home, take herself for her, not move
I'm
much.
I'm just going to stay here for eight more years and hope that nobody behind you, because, yeah, there's no point resigning now. Now, but however, a justice like Kennedy may say, okay, now I can resign and allow the president to
appoint. Sure, because he's a Reagan appointee, so it doesn't matter,
he's a
right?
conservative,
but
if you will.
So is Ruth Bader
but for
the
me,
only,
it's a,
only lefty that's could... Oh, no, Stephen Breyer.
Yeah, and I wouldn't. I don't want to characterize this as left or right, because that's not accurate.
Right.
In the case of the Supreme Court justice, to me, they're either a strict constructionist...
Constructionist.
...or they believe in a... organic constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, our founders could have never contemplated cell phones, and so do you have a right to privacy in your cell phone? Well, the strict constructionist says, yeah, that's one of your effects. You have a right to be secure there. And the organic one says, oh, well, they never knew about cell phones, and so we're free to make a decision based on what we think it is. So the idea that the Constitution is a living document and can be changed at will.
Are the constructionists more tend to be more on the right politically?
Yes, because that's the conservative view, that the Constitution was written in plain language for regular folks. It doesn't need judges to interpret what it says.
Uh-huh.
You know, like that, a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, period. So what that amendment is saying, Second Amendment is saying to me is that a well-regulated militia, a well-trained, you know, knows how to use a gun, not afraid of them, that a militia, every able-bodied person 17 to 45 who's not otherwise conscripted, that armed body of people that knows how to use firearms, is not currently under federal supervision, is necessary for the security of a free state. You must have an armed populace ready to defend their rights at any given time. And so because of that, that last comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The right of the people to keep and bear arms. Now, the strict constructionist reads that the way that I do. Can't deny it. But the organic Constitution says, oh, no, the militia, that's the army, and the army's got to have guns, but the people have no individual right under the Second Amendment to have a gun.
Oh,
well, in the plain reading of that will tell you otherwise, but their concept of an organic document would never have contemplated the sort of firepower and weaponry that are available today. We're not talking about muskets. We're talking about assault weapons.
Muskets.
And bombs, right? So because the forefathers never imagined that you next door could buy a Thompson submachine gun, then they must not have thought about this thoroughly. I disagree. That whatever the weapon of the day is, our forefathers believed that individuals should have access to that weapon, because when only the government is armed, then people fear their government. When the people are armed, boy, the government fears the people, and they act accordingly.
Franklin writes in, you dissed the Convention of States and obviously do not know what it is. Don't call it a constitutional convention. It is not. The Convention of States will propose amendments to the Constitution, replaces Congress for this function. When the majority of 34 states accept the amendment, the amendment is then sent to the state legislature for ratification as if it had come from Congress. There's
Correct.
No way that you can have a runaway convention of states.
With a convention of the states.
Get
That's
more
right.
information at theconventionofstates.com.
Yes. Absolutely. Say that again. Theconventionofstates.com. It's not a constitutional convention. And I participated in one 2 years ago, the Florida Roundtable, and we got together and had a discussion, and a lot of members from various states were there. And so this idea of a convention of the states is not a constitutional convention, and I support it wholeheartedly. So forgive me if the impression was that I dissed this particular method. What we were talking about was a constitutional convention, a convention that's called for the sole purpose of amending the Constitution and not suggesting constitutional amendments that are then ratified by the states according to that method. So this method is the perfect method because it can limit a runaway convention because a convention doesn't happen. It is, hey, we all got together, we proposed these three amendments, two amendments, one. The balanced budget one seems to be the one everyone wants. And so now we send it to the states to ratify. And if the states ratify it, hey, then it has that same process of law and it actually amends the Constitution. So conventionofstates.com. I do not oppose. I think it's a great idea.
Well, what would happen if somehow the people forced the government to balance the budget? I mean, it could that could be ugly in a way. I mean, it's a great idea, but with this system, would it? Could you even do it?
Sure you can.
Could you?
Absolutely.
You'd have to really cut government, like, massively, like, massively.
I mean, or as Grover Norquist put it, I don't want to kill government. I just want to shrink it to the size that I can drown it in a bathtub.
Yeah, and that's what you'd have to do, right?
The overreach by our federal government into areas that are clearly within the jurisdiction of the state, such as education, the environment, and so forth.
Yeah.
If you just strip them of all that extra jurisdictional power and sent them back to their function as defined in the Constitution, you could easily... even if you just that baseline budgeting nonsense where, you know, whatever the budget was last year, that's our baseline for this year. And so whether we need it or not, that's how much we're starting with. And that, I mean, that's absurd. The zero based budgeting where you go back to nothing and, you know, what do you need this year? That's what we need. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, and you could you could pull 160 bases back and just have a nice strong defense in case anybody bombed you and you'd be fine. You know, how much would that cost?
Yeah.
I mean, how much would that cost?
160,
yeah,
I don't know.
A couple hundred billion, whatever.
Yeah,
nothing, man.
Yeah.
Chump change.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not going to happen.
No, it's not, because of the gentleman such as John McCain, who recognizes that 76 cents of every currently collected tax dollar goes just to service the debt. So that leaves roughly a quarter out of every dollar collected as left over for everything else. And Mr. McCain proposes that we spend that whole quarter on defense. A hawk if ever I've seen one. And at the same time, having no concern or no exhibited concern for the veterans who fight these wars. So the idea of wasting money to support and protect the rest of the world. I do agree again with Mr. Trump. You know, let Japan pay for the cost of its defense. Let South Korea pay for the cost of keeping those troops in Korea and defending them against North Korea. So we've just borne the brunt of all this expense for decades, mm-hmm. and it's time for the rest of the world to pitch in for their own protection.
Well, let's just get real nationalist for a second and wave a magic wand. So you just pull everybody back, and you know we got as many.
You don't necessarily pull them back, but you send them a bill, $14,000 per troop per year.
Pull them home, like George Washington said, this is a land of wars. You know, stay away from these guys. Just trade with them. I mean, you could do it, and
you could.
You say to Russia, China, nuclear, you know, and North Korea, we got nukes. You know, you drive up a boat on San Francisco Beach, or you send one over, and we're just going to lob you one, and we'll just blow each other up. So I don't think anybody would mess with us. So
that's the MAD policy, the mutual assured destruction.
But why would you need to be protecting North Korea from South Korea, protecting Syria, and let those guys fight it out? And the worst that could happen, you got $10 gas. It's a lot cheaper than $8 trillion defense budget.
Well, that's true. The reality of that situation is we've spent, since 1913, organizing the world. Actually, I would go back to the 1890s.
So we've been that long.
Yeah. We've organized the world in our image. And so when something upsets our apple cart, like all of the profits that are being generated by having manufacturing in South Korea with a free import policy and the banks being allowed into South Korea to swamp all their securities markets and to draw deposits from their country, you know, that's a franchise that the boys want to protect. Mm-hmm. And what do they protect it with? Well, a war. Even though it might not make sense to us.
They just do it.
Behind the scenes, they know why they have to do it. They just can't ever share that reason with us. So that's why we hear these ridiculous weapons of mass destruction and
sure.
the domino theory and so on and so forth. But
right.
if in harsh reality we say, okay, South Korea, you want our troops there to protect you, fine. It costs us $14,000 a year to keep a soldier in your country. We have 100,000 soldiers. Here's your bill.
Oops. Yeah, now you're talking.
Now we could do that. Now I have no problem with it because we, the taxpayers, are not paying for the security of Korea. But that's the way it is now. And gentlemen like John McCain only perpetuate the system. We need some folks in there with some fresh thoughts to shake it up.
John writes in, my wife will make $240,000 this year. Good for you. We do not own a home. Is there any other way to reduce our tax burden? I'm a stay-at-home dad at the present time. Man, mom's pulling down. That's good. Good for mom.
No, you must.
You must do something.
Must. You either buy a house
yeah.
or you pay the tax. And if you think about it, you know, a mortgage, she's making $240 a year.
Yeah.
You want a 95% mortgage because you're already paying rent.
Just use that debt as a blessing, right?
Absolutely.
Amen.
So, yes and no. Maybe, okay, maybe there is a strategy B, which is tell her employer that she no longer works for the employer, form a corporation, and the corporation provides the service to the employer, and then the corporation retains a portion of its earnings at the lower tax rate, and at the same time pays a salary lot less than $240,000. By the time you're done with that maneuvering, you might as well just buy a house. Why, goodness, don't you... Aren't you bothered by the fact that the place you live is not in your jurisdiction? Your landlord can come by and say, I don't like the way the grass looks. I don't like the way the shutters look.
Maybe he's got his house paid for or something.
Yeah, I don't know.
So what if he had his house?
He said we don't own
a
home.
He did say that. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
I missed that part.
That means we rent. And when you're renting your home, you have no jurisdiction in that place. I mean, you do have a leasehold interest, which is the least powerful form of ownership. But the landlord has the ultimate right to do and say anything concerning your property. And I don't see why that's a comfort to you. And most renters, I don't understand how you could be comfortable knowing that there's a landlord that tells you what to
Lord,
do.
Lord,
yeah,
Lord.
Yeah, get rid of the Lord and replace him with a mortgage. You know, the amount of money that you'll save just on your tax bill alone in this instance will justify. Because $240 at 35% rate.
That's huge, man. You get clobbered.
Woo! Yeah. You're already paying a mortgage. It's just that you're not getting the house. The mortgage money's going to the federal government. Why wouldn't you put it into your own well-being and your kids' future and so forth? So, stay-at-home dad or not, it's time for you to, like, grab a hold of the real estate book and find yourself a house to move into, and that will take up a little of your time besides that idea of a stay-at-home dad. Now, one of our former brokers who had been with me a very long time, Jason is his name, those of you who have encountered Jason, he made that same choice. He's going to stay at home, and his wife is going to work. He's raising the kids, and she's out doing. So while you're raising the kids, you should be shopping for real estate. And most certainly find yourself something that you can buy and call your own.
So they wouldn't have to move out if they didn't want. Can you still
no.
do you still get interest write-offs if you buy a home and rent it out? Of course, right?
Well, yeah, but the rent that you collect counts as income.
Yeah, so it doesn't yeah.
kind of washes.
Doesn't work as well, yeah.
No.
You got to live.
Buy an investment property and count on the passive income generation. That is a strategy as well, Patrick. Most certainly, let's say that they buy a $500,000 building that doesn't yield enough revenue, enough rent to pay the mortgage and the taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So that portion that they put in from their own pocket would be a deduction,
mm-hmm.
but it's nowhere near the home ownership deduction. That one is sort of the – because you can do 95% financing on the home, So that doesn't tie up your available cash. And your rent and mortgage payments will probably be competitive when you figure in the tax formula. So I'm not a realtor, but I can't abide a renter making $240,000 a year unless your job is such that you're not going to be there more than a year. There's no other reason. And then you should have a home base where you own a home. So please buy a house. Before you're paying for it anyway, you might as well own it.
Is there any creative way to roll over a low-rate mortgage? Anthony writes, for example, if you have a great interest rate, but then you want to move and buy another house some years in the future when interest rates are much higher, can you take that with you? No, I don't think so. Can you?
Maybe. Not that I'm aware of, not in the United States. I know they do have those portable mortgages in Europe, but in the U.S., I don't believe we have any products yet. What I would say is that you want to equity strip your existing home rather than selling it. So if that is your intent, you have this great mortgage and you have equity, you want to just strip the equity and park it in a checking account until you can find the home that you want to buy. So there also is the option of a second mortgage on the existing property, albeit at a higher rate. Most times, though, you're going to find that you have to refi and surrender that attractive rate, especially if you're one of our listeners who, when rates went sub 4%, you remember I was screaming at the top of my lungs that, you know, this is kind of the bottom. Get your butt in there and refinance that house. Debt is a blessing. So if you've paid off your mortgage, man, you better go get a mortgage right now.
Andrew Goss and Patrick Timpone.
To talk to Patrick, call 888-663-6386 or email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Here's Patrick.
Don't talk to me. You talk to Andrew. He'll do the thing for you. This is from Oz. Let's see. Love the show, The Real World of Money. As I predicted, three-hour shows are becoming more than normal. Can't wait for tomorrow. We'll try and post some questions, but just wondering if you could kindly send me the link. The link that you use to watch Bitcoin, the amount's been traded and all that. Oh, I can send that to you. Okay, that's for me. I've got some link. He likes to look at that Bitcoin thing. I am an SDL customer and have this question for my friend about the difference between stamp and coin collections. Okay, he feels strongly after losing money on rare stamps that rare coin collections for long-term investments are similar and have the same downside risk. Can you compare and contrast the two, please, for me?
Yeah, you know, the stamp market was killed by the UN.
The UN? Oh, man.
Once we gave them franking privilege, the ability to create stamps so that they could write to their constituents, well, then they started creating stamps to sell for profit. And every variety of stamp was affected. And it pretty much washed out the market for collectors because of increased supply. So, unfortunately, there is a limitless supply of stamps with themes, and the supplies created really dwarf the number of collectors that are out there. And, quite frankly, stamps have kind of fallen by the wayside, as mail has fallen by the wayside. So the heyday of the stamp collecting market was probably during Franklin Roosevelt's term, when everyone used them and they were, you know, every day, every communication engaged a stamp. And you had a very fixed supply and increasing demand. Now the reverse is true. And what I've found in many of the stamp collections that I've engaged myself in, something that, like a coin that we would buy for a dollar, even the rarest one, we wouldn't sell for more than $1.40 or $1.50. A stamp that they buy for a dollar might sell for $3. So the spread between buy and sell in the stamp market is gigantic. And you have to make up all of that before you gain any profit. And the philately area, right? Well, I'm glad I'm a numismatist, not a philatelist. so the philately area, the stamp collectors, is not a very big organization, where the Numismatic Association is gigantic. It is in the millions, number of members millions, of the American Numismatic, millions. And we have the American Numismatic Society in New York. We have, the, of course, the National Collection at the Smithsonian. We have the museum in Colorado Springs. And the exposure of the coin market is such that it has just outpaced the stamp market. So for me, numismatics are a much superior form to a philatelist or philately. And it seems to make more sense to buy something physical and tangible, in the case of gold, that's made of precious metal and that cannot be created or duplicated in supply. If the UN can whip out plates and just start striking, I mean, they even do what they call tribute stamps, which are replications of the previous stamp. And, you know, again, that does nothing to help the marketplace. They have increasing supply and decreasing demand. So I'm not big on stamps, and sorry you had that experience, but I assure you that over the long term, no collectible will outperform rare gold and silver coins, American coins.
Well, Andrew, you told us it was going to be fun with President Trump, and the biggest case in WTO history as Europe prepares legal challenges against the Trump border tax. So he's going to, you know, there's going to be a huge, they're going to have another line item just for all the attorneys that the administration has got to pony up to, because there's going to be a lot of pushback on any of this stuff, right? The tariffs.
Well, the fact that we have to ask anyone.
I know.
I mean, how did we get ourselves into that in the first place, that we have a World Trade Organization and that we are subject to their jurisdiction, and they can take us to what? Court? What is this court? What are we talking about? The Supreme Court is the court.
What are we talking about here?
Yeah. What is there? When did this? So anyway, that whole idea, that whole concept that we are not even free to establish our own trade policy should be a wake-up call to all Americans that we're marching steadily towards a global government, and that this flexing of that muscle will be probably the first shot across the bow, no doubt not the last.
Which is why the boys don't like Mr. Trump's hairdo or hair or policies.
You know? And why they're using their other organization, while it still has teeth, to try to force the United States back into line.
Uh-huh.
But the people of Europe are going to take it a sledgehammer to that World Trade Organization very soon.
Well, I'm sure Mr. Trump is really, really worried about this one. You talked about having fun. Michael Moore, he's tweeting out this morning, 1 hour after Obama put sanctions on Russia, you told Flynn to call them to promise it'll be okay. Traitor, resign by morning. He's only the first to go. One by one, they will drop the so-called president. Is you fired up next, blah, blah, blah. Wow. I mean, Michael Moore is saying that you really have to resign or we're going to impeach you. So I'm sure Mr. Trump's concerned about that. You think they're having a meeting at the White House on this morning?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure this is like topic one, whether or not he should resign.
Because Michael Moore says,
okay, you're right, Michael. I'm resigning. It's morning. I hope I'm not too late.
Mark,
what a buffoon.
He's just something old. Mark in Bastrop, Texas. Regarding mortgage notes being lost and not returned to borrowers, I paid a 7% APR countrywide mortgage in 2001. And at the time, I received a reconveyance certificate, but without the canceled note. Last October, about 15 years later, Bank of America found the original note and mailed it to me, stamped, paid in full. Oh.
Yay.
That's pretty rare, isn't it?
That is very rare.
Mm-hmm.
But typical of what they will do, that certificate of reconveyance. Like, we don't know where the thing is, but we're going to just give you whatever our interest in the house is. We're passing it back to you. So,
oh, is that what that is?
That's what they did, yeah.
That's reconveyance. So,
yeah, but of course now, 15 years later, finally he owns his house. Congratulations.
Will writes in, it seems like Andy is in favor of central banks leaning against the wind in order to prevent market volatility. He also has plenty of criticisms of the Federal Reserve. My question is, would nationalizing the Federal Reserve improve our situation? I suspect Andy will say yes, but if he does, then why was Andrew Jackson killing the Second Bank of the United States a good thing? Did that not just create an institutional vacuum that corrupt private industry monopolized on?
Okay, so Jerry North has famously called me an intellectual schizophrenic. Like, I understand the Federal Reserve. I know how it operates, but still, I'm not opposed to fiat money. The idea that the government should be allowed to go short dollars that it may need this year and won't collect as revenue until next year, that should be something that the government could do without interest. So if we nationalize the Federal Reserve and all of the profits from it, its operations flowed into the Treasury, then that would sanitize any costs that the Treasury currently incurs in order to go short dollars. Andrew Jackson was dramatically opposed to paper money in every form as issued by the government. So his belief is that, okay, this is a private right, and if individuals want to take paper money, they can, but the law is not going to force them to do so. That's an entirely different concept. It is that sound money as the Constitution requires. So remember, the Articles of Confederation gave the Congress the power to, quote, emit bills of credit or create paper money. That power was taken away from them with the Constitution and then further delegated by them to the Federal Reserve. So rather than take that power back from the Federal Reserve, simply nationalizing the Fed or even making it a quasi-public corporation so that the revenues flow directly into the Treasury and any appropriation that the Fed needs would have to be made in the well of Congress. Now, that will, of course, take away some of the opaqueness of the financial markets. So the idea, the thought that the Fed can make all these operations off the books, so to speak, not in the public view, gives them more power. And taking away that power by nationalizing the Fed would, of course, force them to operate more transparently, and that's something that they're very loath to do. I hope that answers the question. I believe that fiat money, money that is not backed by immediate gold and silver deposits, has a place in the modern U.S. economy, whereas many people of my understanding don't believe that anyone should be allowed to issue fiat money, that there's a gold standard and nothing else. And so, unfortunately, I'm not one of those people. Although I understand the concept, I think that given this current, we can't get there from here. It would be decades before our nation would be ready to get back on a strict gold standard. We have to first curb our appetite for debt.
Sylvia writes in, can you explain why the Organic Act of 1871 is relevant today?
Well, many argue that it created a second constitution. It sort of conferred the power that was reserved to the states back onto the federal government. So the Act of 1871 is really the second constitution in which it redefined the role of the federal government and essentially gave them jurisdiction over all the things they didn't have jurisdiction over before. So that's another one of those post-Civil War Reconstruction era laws that I'm opposed to. And incidentally, coins from 1871, 1872, 1873, you know, when all of this was taking place, and then, of course, the various panics that are the result, are some of the rarest coins in the marketplace today. So there's more to 1871 than just that Organic Act, which created, effectively, the Federal District of Columbia, and what many call U.S. Inc., USA Inc.
Inc. Is that the Articles of Confederation or the Northwest Ordinance, or is this another one?
No, this is way, way after either of those, right? This is 1871.
Wow, this is pretty late in the game.
Yeah. It's post-Civil War, in which, again, the issue of states' rights was adjudicated on the battlefield. The idea that states have a superior power to the federal government, that they have their own states' rights, was pretty much squashed and put in a can.
When the North
and
won.
Right. Labeled as the Act of 1871.
Okay, this is a spoils of war kind of thing.
Essentially, good way to put it. Yeah. And it's why I refer to this engagement as the war between the states and the federal government. That's what it was. It was the states exercising elucidating their right to states' rights for the state to make its own determination. And the federal government said, no, you don't have that right.
No, we
have jurisdiction. And the Act of 1871 sort of codified that. But again, you can't amend the Constitution in such a way. And, you know, the former springs from the latter and so forth. So I'm still a believer that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. And we can easily get back to that if we eliminate all of these extra jurisdictional issues.
Bob writes in, I wonder if Andy has a real-world example for us about buying a gold coin from him and the possibilities. I want to turn back the clock to 1982 when I was a poor young guy with $5,000 in savings with little financial direction. I call up Andy that year and say I want a gold coin, and he sells me one single coin for the cash. I still don't know much about the gold coin he sold me, but I have visions of splendor. Please tell me what coin Andy would have sold me and what it's worth today. Oh, so he's kind of, he's kind of doing a little what-if thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hindsight is 20/20,
so that's
though.
Kind of,
okay.
Yeah, okay. Well, just for
all right,
fun,
so
yeah, what would you
have done? One of my clients did this very thing.
In the early
he came to visit me at the office in North Jersey maybe 6 years ago, and he said, yeah, I think I'm just going to buy bullion, and, you know, why shouldn't I? And so I made the case that rare coins outperform bullion 2-1, sometimes 3-1. He goes, oh, yeah, so if you had $25,000 and you bought rare coins in 1982, which would you buy?
Uh-huh.
And we were standing outside, and I listed a group of coins. So it's not like I ran inside and looked in the book. But one of those coins
you knew.
Yes, of course.
All right.
So 1889 Carson City silver dollar was one of my picks. So was the 1909 S VDB cent. So was the 1911 D. So I went and picked the key coins to each series, and I said, you know, these are the coins I would have bought.
Uh-huh.
So Dr. Piatti goes back to the Red Books, and he puts together the most methodical analysis I've seen yet of a comparable investment in rare coins and in bullion, tracking back 30 years. Puts us right at about the period that the writer is asking about.
Uh-huh.
So I would urge you to call my 800 number and ask for the booklet that I made out of this report entitled Rare Coins Versus Bullion. And this writer, Dr. Biotti, made this analysis of both categories without the benefit of, you know, anybody can look back 30 years in a book and say, okay, this one was X and now it's 10X.
Yeah, I should have bought this one, right?
Right. Yeah. I did this on the fly. And he wrote them down as I was standing there, so that objectivity. And then he went back and analyzed the data. It stunned me. So I always knew it was better, but I didn't realize it was that much better. And so I would urge the writer, please email me or call the 800 number and request that booklet report. I'll send it to you and anyone else who wants one.
What's it called?
Free of charge. Yep, just call 800-468-2646 and ask, say you heard it on Patrick's radio show and you want a copy of Rare Coins Versus Bullion. It's a 30-year analysis, and boy, does it prove the point that select rare coins have outperformed just about every other solid or tangible investment over the last 30 years, bar none.
Now, select is a key word here. You got to be dealing with somebody like yourself who knows what they're doing.
Well, you better be getting certified coins.
Yeah,
now, we didn't
course.
Even have certification until 1987. So, you know, you might have bought a coin in 1982 that was proposed as uncirculated and later turned out to be circulated.
Right.
So all of that notwithstanding, this is assuming you bought what you were supposed to get, you got what you were supposed to get, and you held it through the entire term. And so, believe me, there are some great examples in that list. My favorite, of course, that 89 Carson City, but I can't overlook the 1911 D2.5, which in 1982 you could have bought for around $900, $1,000, and it's now $10,000 or $15,000. So there are a great number of examples like that. Get the report, Rare Coins versus Bullion, read it yourself, and then make your own decision.
Here's a coin kind of guy here. I've been attending a local coin show, lots of them armed with the knowledge that from your show and a 2013 Red Book that your partner Fred sent me. I was confused when the price of the 2013 Red Book and the price of the coin were the same. Sometimes the coin was a little bit less. I felt this was an example of weak hands and bought the coin, 1925 Stone Mountain MS-66, for $315. I used the awesome coins that Fred sent me as a reference. Once I pulled out one of your MS-66 to compare, I felt like I had a competitive advantage. When the opportunity to buy a coin with $2016 at the 2013 price appears, is the correct move to buy the coin? I hope because I bought a bunch. LOL.
Heck yeah.
Heck yeah.
And, you know, one of the things I've told my clients is I go out and I scour the countryside and try to buy as many of these coins as I can find, but I can't find them all. And so if you find one and follow the same criteria, see, that is the point. As I've said many times, it doesn't matter who you buy them from. You don't have to buy them from me. As long as you follow those same basic rules, whip out a price guide, make sure it's certified by NGC, take physical possession, heck yeah, you're going to get a good buy. And I'm so happy that you've used the knowledge that you gained by listening to the show to benefit yourself. And you're doing the leg work that I would normally do. You know, for what most people, they don't want to schlep to a coin show and walk through the aisles and look at 900 coins. They'd much rather hear Andy call, hey, I have a Stone Mountain in 66. It'll cost you $300. You know, that is a lot easier for the armchair collector who doesn't want to be directly involved. So, you know, the same can be said for any trade. You can go buy your own starter and replace it in your car, or you could take it to the mechanic and let him replace it. Either way, if you have a good mechanic, you're not going to get gouged. You're going to pay a fair price and so forth. So you, as you noticed from your trips to the coin show, the difference between what Fred would sell you a coin for and what you might be able to buy it for at a coin show is not that great. And in fact, the knowledge that Fred would give you eliminates your requirement to know, hey, there were a lot of Stone Mountains made. There was a million of them made. And so you have one in a very high condition. And so it's a condition rarity. And maybe you'd be better off with a Texas, which has 1/10 of the mintage, or an Oregon. So all of that market knowledge you can't hope to gain from a Red Book. But at least if you follow the basic rules that we give you, you won't lose to malfeasance or overgrading or overpricing. And so I'm happy that you found it a good way to buy coins. And now that you have this knowledge, you can buy them anywhere. As long as you follow the basic rules, you're not going to get taken advantage of.
The chief economist at Citi, which would be definitely one of the boards.
Primary owner of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah. Sees the dollar rising this year, even as the president talks the greenback down and blasts some of the nation's biggest trading partners for currency manipulation. He says this is all basically hogwash. He said during an interview with Bloomberg, all of this currency manipulation talk is, I think, basically hot air. No matter how hard the Trump administration rattles the cage in an attempt to talk the dollar down, if the markets anticipate significant future stimulus and the U.S. and future tightening by the Fed, then whatever short-term wobbles there may be in the U.S. dollar, the dollar will only go one way, relatively to most other currencies, and that's up. And I guess that's what Trader Scott has been saying too for a while too. He's bullish on the dollar still.
Cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry.
Yeah. So this guy's into something, huh?
But to suggest that we that the Japanese aren't manipulating their currency or that the Chinese aren't manipulating their currency, see, a professional like that would view that, well, that's open market operations. That's not manipulation. So when the central bank of a country is unnaturally buying assets that the rest of the country isn't buying, that's currency manipulation. When they're driving interest rates lower in an attempt to cheapen their currency, that's currency manipulation. When a central bank adds a bunch of new currency into the marketplace through quantitative easing, that's currency manipulation. I don't care what you guys want to call it. When a central bank interferes with the market value of a currency, that is currency manipulation. The Chinese are guilty of it. The Japanese are guilty of it. And guess what? The U.S. is guilty of it. So stop. If you stop and let the marketplace decide what currency is worth, you'll quickly realize they'll all sink to the bottom. But as I've used the analogy before, you know, all of us have jumped out of an airplane, and yeah, the dollar might be falling slower than the yen, but we're all heading for the ground. The reality is there is no substance behind our currency, and without substance, it can only evaporate. So it might do so slower than the rest, and that's, again, the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry analogy. You got to put on a shirt, and this is the cleanest one, so that's the one that they're putting on, and goodness, it doesn't mean it doesn't stink, but it will certainly get you out into the public without your chest exposed.
Out this morning, we had some pretty good inflation in January, right? Pretty good, more than they expected, and so Goldman is raising their rate hike odds after January inflation spike. So,
pretty good
chance that they're gonna she's gonna go raise another rates. Quarter points in March.
Sure,
right?
Sure, that's what they're gonna do.
And then but the boys are out there just not talking. They think things are not good. I mean, Deutsche Bank is out saying, "Boy, this is not gonna end well. Donald Trump is way off base." So, you know, they're not gonna let up on him, are they?
No, they're not. And because his policies will upset the apple cart, you know, it's just not going to make it easy for the globalists to keep their agenda in place. You can expect this sort of resistance from every arena.
Every arena. All right, kiddo, thanks for a great show. It is, we almost went 3 hours, but what's up for you today? You're gonna be going back to Jersey for next
week? Yeah,
next
we're week? Packing up. That's
really?
Exactly what's going on for the rest of the week.
Going
we're packing
north.
Up and heading north. A lot of the coins that I bought while I was down here are coming with me, and so I'll have plenty to offer.
Yeah.
No problem if you want to talk to me, however. I'll still be in the office. 800-468-2646. Share your thoughts. Let me know your goals, and perhaps we can work together.
Good job.
800-468-2646.
Thanks, Andrew. Andrew Goss, Patrick Timpone, 800-468-2646. I know we got a good show lined up for you tomorrow, just at the top of my head, and I don't have time because the music's going. I'm just not sure who it is, but believe me, I'll be here at 9 o'clock. Hope you will, too. Thanks to Sharon for everything that she does for us, and to Lynn, who takes notes a couple times a week. Good job, ladies, and we appreciate your ongoing support of our rebounders and the sauna and the sulfur and Ken Rodel's products and all the other good things. That's how we support ourselves. Buying through Amazon. So keep it up. Keeps us in the green here to make our house payment and so I can buy colostrum just like you. I love you all very much. We will see you tomorrow, 9 o'clock Central Time.
Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.